Welcome to the podcast version of Sunday Miscellany, which differs from the radio version for rights reasons. We hope you enjoy the programme.
My childhood was peopled by heroes. They were all dead, and except for Michael Collins, they were all related to me. They were also all men. This is not to say that the women of the family were not strong. In fact, most of them were heroines. But they were alive, so they were not so romantic. My hero was my father. I forgot to mention that all my heroic relations were also handsome, and he was probably the handsomest of them all. He had a studio portrait taken 3 weeks before he died. It's on my desk in a silver frame. He is looking straight at me, smiling slightly. He is wearing a dark formal suit with a white shirt and striped tie. Everyone said it was quite out of character for him to have a portrait photograph taken. It was noted as strange by all the family at the time, and it's an odd fact that this was the only photograph which existed of him. He died when I was 4, and he was 38. I was born in the early morning hours of the 31st of May 1941, the night the Germans bombed Dublin's North Strand by mistake. My mother said it was typical of me. It was also typical of me, she said, that I was late. I had been expected a week earlier. My father, on the other hand, thought it was absolutely appropriate. His daughter had arrived, accompanied by a crescendo of thunderous sound, which probably awakened most of the population of Dublin and lit up the night sky for miles around. So there I was, a late exhibitionist. My brothers throughout our childhood mentioned this a lot, especially when they had to wait for me, or I made a particularly striking entrance. On the morning after I was born, while the unfortunate citizens of the North Strand were clearing the rubble, my father was buying out the sweet shop at the end of our street for all the children in our neighbourhood. I know this because it was told to me repeatedly by my mother, my aunts and practically all our neighbours, over and over while I was growing up. You were born the night the bombs fell on the North Strand and your father bought out the sweet shop the next day. This was no flight of fancy. I had it from the shopkeeper himself. Paddy Bro had opened his sweet shop in Dean Street, just around the corner from St. Patrick's Cathedral, long before I was born. But he liked nothing better than to lean on his counter between the glass jars of butterballs, bull's eyes and satin cushions and recount the tale of my birth to anyone who would listen, but especially to me, and I was a very willing audience. "Never was a man so delighted by anything," he would tell me. "Paddy," he said, "I have a daughter and she's the most beautiful thing you've ever seen in your life." He was that proud of you, there were sparks coming out of his eyes and he wanted the whole world to know about it. Then he suddenly said, "Paddy, I have a great idea." And off he went into the street and brought in all the kids he could find. "Give them whatever they want," he said. And then he bought out the shop for them. "It was the best day's business I ever had," Paddy would always say, and never fail to add, "You know, he was a lovely man, was your father, Gus Joyce." I think he must have been, and though I only know him as a memory told to me by others, his effect on my life has been profound. As the years went by and I grew up, I would look at myself in the cracked mirror of his dressing table. Small and skinny, with short, straight, mousy hair, a late exhibitionist. But what did I care? Inside was a golden core of confidence. I was the girl whose father had bought out the sweet shop for her. In due course, I would emerge again as the most beautiful thing you have ever seen in your life. I would look at his photograph in its silver frame and know it was only a matter of time. Thank you.
There are, to my mind, just two reasons to have children. Reason A, they are lovely. And reason B, you will need them when you are older to care for you, to wash you, to check in on you. This will be their duty. The future needs a workforce, and until automated beings can care adequately for us, children will be needed. These are the two reasons. There are no more. There are, however, many, many arguments against children. They're loud. They are unreasonable. They consume vital planetary resources. They are, you can argue, breathtakingly stupid. A while ago, my then one-month-old son lay happily upon the changing table. He waited, biding his time, until we had removed his nappy, then expelled a long stream of newborn urine back onto himself. A perfect arc, a mathematically exact parabola, right into his own mouth. He squirmed under the constant stream of whittle, twisting this way and that, trying to escape his own self-imposed waterboarding. Distraught and wrought with fury, he then wept at length, humiliated by his own hand. He repeated the action a couple of weeks later, this time taking the opportunity to urinate directly into his own left eye. And this, again, was a surprise to him. He looked up at me, eyes squinting, face wet, shocked, for all the world at a loss to explain why I had done such a thing to him. And then he screamed, crying, agitated, clueless. These are not the actions of an intelligent person. Other parents, and if you choose to become a parent, you will have to meet them, like to inform you of the intelligent things their babies have done. Their one-month-old knows a dog. Their six-week-old smiled at a joke. They have personalities, they say, right out of the womb. They are conniving or cunning, sly, manipulative, wry with an observational air. Without the ability to form mental images or to understand language or basic don't we in your own eye logic, they are still little budding Einsteins, people pleasers, bon vivants, charmers. Here is some partial evidence against the intelligence of babies. They cannot feed, clothe, protect or clean themselves. I don't see any of them helping out about the house, doing the dishes, contributing to the crossword or cleaning the gutters. And here I think you will point out that we should be using the term smart loosely. What people mean, you will say, is smart for a baby, intelligent for a child. This sort of relative measure of intelligence is insulting to the child, condescending. If they truly are all that smart, they would object to such lazy, subjective ideas of comparative intelligence. Babies, in absolute terms, are dumbasses. Dumber than dogs, squirrels, and perhaps even various types of mushroom. My son is not the smartest man in the world, but so what? He smiles at me. He falls asleep on my chest. The other day, I wagged my head back and forth, side to side, and he imitated me with a rising corner lip that you could definitely say was a smile. It was definitely a smile. His warm head goes against my heart, feeling its beat. He weeps when he is tired and overwhelmed, and he exhales deep when I push him against myself. I lie down and he sits in my chest and looks around in wonder, unsure of what is going on, unclear on what the nature of all this is. At night, electrical signals pulse through his brain and he does not sleep, his limbs jerking about in random directions, and all manner of different expressions come over his face, growing in number and complexity every day. The brain working itself out, trying to figure out what goes where. Test a smile, cry. Test a grin, grin. Test a suspicious look towards your father, glare. Only a couple of months old and he has no idea who I am in any conscious sense or what a father is. He does not know anything, as far as I can see, except that he likes it there against me. He likes it when I walk with him strapped to my chest at 7 a.m, singing songs to him. Going in hard in Irish ballads because a history and tradition of heartbreak, unfairness, woe, humour and longing are my gift to him. He may not appreciate my tone, range or timbre, but he goes quiet when I make these sounds, soothed. And he snores against me, drools on my jumper, wheeze against me, poos on my hand, vomits on my jeans, giggles when I tickle him, presses his skin against mine, pulls my chest hair, sighs, sighs, grins, sighs. He is lovely. In time, I hope he will come to appreciate the care I've put into him. And when it comes time for reason B, time to care for me when I am old or sick, I will probably have reminded him enough of the times I cleaned him, fed him, walked him, stayed up late with him, loved him, cared for him. He sighs against me, my gorgeous son. There, in all its stretching depth, the real reason to have children. Reason A, they are lovely. He is lovely. And reason enough.
Dublin's first Bloomsday took place on the 16th of June, 1954. 50 years on from the date on which Joyce had set Ulysses, the rambling journey through a day in the city he called the Hibernian metropolis. Given that Clonbrassil Street is today home to a plaque that notes Leopold Bloom was born here in Joyce's imagination, the date on which the book is set seems every bit as important as its publication date. And in Dublin, events don't actually have to have happened to be commemorated. When the date rolled around in 1954, it was unsurprising some would seek to mark it. Indeed, even earlier, there were true believers doing that in other places. In 1927, Joyce himself wrote in a letter that there is a group of people who observe what they call Bloomsday, 16th of June. I have to convince myself that I wrote that book. Now there were Dublin disciples wanting in on the idea of Bloomsday. For others, the jury was still out. When the 100th anniversary of Bloomsday comes around, the Irish Times editorial noted, Leopold Bloom either may be forgotten or may stand in stone effigy as high as Nelson stands today. Little could they have known that by then Horatio Nelson's pillar would be gone and a statue of James Joyce would be staring at its replacement. It was a certain Brian O'Nolan, or Miles Nigopoline, who set upon the idea. To him, Joyce's works were a garden in which some of us may play. And assembling a symbolic cast of characters, he referred to the day as the Jant. The poet, Anthony Cronin, remembered Miles approaching him with the idea in a Dublin pub. It would be necessary to go somewhere else, Cronin recalled, for there were too many dangerous people, chancers and intriguers and go-betweens and Johnny-come-latelys of all descriptions in the pub we were in. They decided to assemble, fittingly, in the home of the architect Michael Scott, beside the Martello Tower in which Joyce's tale begins. And in two horse-drawn cabs, they would emulate the day. In the party was John Ryan, the editor of Envoy magazine, and a man who had once gone to an auction house to buy an electric toaster and come home the owner of a public house, the Bailey, instead. Also there was Patrick Kavanagh, who just a few short years earlier had poured scorn on the emerging Joyce industry. What weapon was used to slay mighty Ulysses? The weapon that was used was a Harvard thesis. A.J. Leventhal, though he may not have realised it, was invited to symbolically represent Dublin's Jewish community, while the dentist, Tom Joyce, represented, well, the Joyce name. And Ryan, in his memoir, Remembering How We Stood, which Dublin wags proclaimed would better be titled Remembering How We Stumbled, recalled that Tom Joyce was a cousin of James, a dentist who had, in fact, never read Ulysses. That the day descended into a drinking session early on is well documented, not least thanks to an overlooked figure in the story of that first Bloomsday. This is the photographer, Eleanor O'Brien Wiltshire, one of the great chroniclers of a changing Dublin, who this day found herself capturing ceremonies. Her patience clearly knew no bounds. Images from outside Goggins in Monkstown reveal a party that is still broadly held together, but shots later on in the day show members of the party being helped back into their carriages and Miles Nagopoline with his head in his hands. Kavanagh's biographer, Antoinette Quinn, would later write that they made several stops along the route at public houses not known for their Joycean associations. But fittingly enough, it all culminated in John Ryan's own establishment, the Bailey on Duke Street. As Cronin recalled, the trip, I am glad to say, ended happily in the back bar of the Old Bailey. The jealousies amongst the mountaineers of the morning seemed to have been forgotten. In some ways, the day is as interesting for who wasn't invited as who was. Proving John Jordan's later observation that Dublin's literary jungle is probably no better or worse, ultimately, than that of any other city. The aggravating hazard, however, lies in the fact that the jungle is miniature and the beasts keep on running into each other. So while we get Patrick Kavanagh, there's no Brendan Behan, a rising star in 1954. And one wonders what sort of cross-checking of names and petty grievances was at play. In 1954, James Joyce's Ulysses was still a very recent thing. It was a living thing. When BBC Radio broadcast a version of it, it was front-page news in Ireland that a Dublin solicitor complained that he'd been libelled in one episode of the broadcast. And maybe he had been. In a work that so playfully blurs fact and fiction, the book exists both as a literary classic and a strange chronicle of the Dublin of its time.
The song Seaside Girls appears many times throughout Ulysses. It appears whenever Leopold Bloom thinks of women, so as you can imagine, that happens quite a lot.
He was sitting bent over on the chair, head in his hands, rocking slightly back and forth. Crying? Crying? I had never seen my father with so much as a misty eye, and yet here he was, crying. Not sobbing, not wailing, but definitely crying. I wouldn't have noticed if he hadn't looked up and muttered, "Where you burn books, you burn people." It was Derry, June 1973. I was 8 years old and just home from school. The library at Brook Park, the People's Park, had been firebombed. I was disturbed seeing my father crying. I was used to seeing him shy or short-tempered, but never this. He was 51 years old and went to the library about once a month on a Saturday, and brought home the pile of books that he would read through in the evenings. He loved history and poetry and lighter local writers like Lynn Doyle and W.F. Marshall. They were food and comfort to him as he worked in all weathers on building sites, carrying hods of bricks up ladders, gripping them so hard that the skin on his hands was broken and chafed. Sitting on the edge of the sofa, using an old wooden chair as a table, he cleaned out the deep hacks with butter and sugar, rubbing the mixture into the open cuts to lift out the dirt and soothe and soften the skin. Butter and sugar, his homemade balm. He used the same chair to cut his tobacco, walnut plug, cutting off a piece and then rubbing it, putting it into the little pouch and then filling the bowl of his pipe. My father was exactly the type of person Brook Park had been created for. The land that had become the park had been bought with a bequest from James Hood Brook, whose will stipulated that the park should be a place where the working man could enjoy on the Sabbath day his pipe and a pleasant walk, or rest after the labours of a severe week's toil. The park opened in August 1901 was laid out as a typical Victorian park, with an oval fish pond and park keepers who would shout and scold if an excited child put a foot on the grass. The library sat at the top of the three sets of stone steps. It had originally been an orphanage for boys, then a museum, before becoming a library and exhibition space with a cannon on the lawn at the front door. And inside, dim light, deep silence, and shelves of books that seemed to stretch as high as the sky. My father's library ticket allowed him to take out 10 books, and every now and again he would take me with him and let me get a book or two from the children's section. These visits entailed what felt like endless hours of standing, trying not to fidget as he peered along the shelves, watching as he lifted down a book, read the back cover, put it back, moved slowly along the shelf, took down another, and maybe this time added it to the pile under his arm. Is it a trick of memory that makes me think I can see him puffing on his pipe during the book selection process? The smell of the pipe smoke sweetening the musty smell of the library. The day I saw my father crying marked the final loss of his sanctuary. The army, on their arrival in 1969, had already taken over part of the library building and removed a lot of the shrubbery from the park. The pond was filled in, and visiting the library was no longer the escape it had been. When it was firebombed, the building was left to decay until it was completely derelict. For a while, the library was housed in porta cabins in a cabin off Infirmary Road, but I don't think my father ever went there. Instead, he created his own personal library service with the owner of the second-hand bookshop at the bottom of Carlisle Road. The small shop was not as grand, but here he could browse and discuss world affairs or the greyhound and horse racing until he settled on the three or four books which he bought. Some of these he kept, but most of them, when he had finished reading, would be traded in for a new batch of books. Lately, the park has been restored, the pond restocked, and a cafe and children's park opened where the library had been. Sitting there recently, was it only wishful thinking that made me believe I could catch the sweet scent of walnut pipe tobacco?
A pub called the Swiss Tavern, once a former toll gatekeeper's cottage, gives Swiss Cottage in northwest London its name. Sitting between a dozen lanes of traffic, like an urban lighthouse, it is connected to the mainland by three sets of pedestrian crossings that bob like marker boys, measuring progress rather than genuinely offering safe passage. You'll need a drink if you make it across. Post-war, Swiss Cottage became home to a number of Jewish refugees from Eastern Europe, among them my maternal grandparents, who would often meet in the Doris, a cafe on the Finchley Road. They would babble over coffee about ordinary things, like any other group of friends. However, fate had plucked them out individually from a sea of destruction and thrown them into a lifeboat together as a small mercy. Stripped of everything they knew and loved and understood to be true, they attempted to rebuild their broken selves in this unassuming corner of London. They seldom lost themselves in laughter. Grief had intercepted that impulse. They had called the Doris the Meow Meow, Polish for I had. Here they reminisced, although they never articulated the true sum of their losses. I had might be measured materially. Nobody had found the mechanism or motivation to calculate the human cost. That was beyond their philosophy. Josek Suker was a Doris regular. He had run the franchise for Baccarat Crystal back in Poland. When Germany invaded Poland on the 1st of September 1939, Josek found himself in England on business, stranded and unable to return home. He desperately searched for news of his wife and two young daughters back home in Kraków, without success. Those first few weeks under occupation saw one rule of law swallow another. Chaos and panic proliferated. Information was contradictory and unreliable. Josek feared that the treachery of not knowing would devour all sense of decorum, function, and sanity itself. Suddenly a flicker of hope. Via a contact in the newly formed Polish underground, a communication could be smuggled out for money. Josek wrote an urgent letter and passed it to his contact, along with £10, an enormous sum in 1939. A month passed. Anxiety was the enemy. Appetite and sleep disappeared like a past tense. Then, one day, he received a letter in his wife's handwriting with two little black and white photographs of his daughters. He took in the contents, line by line. They were safe, for now. Josek pored over the two photographs, relieved, frightened, and almost depleted. A month later, the British government sent a ship to Gdansk in northern Poland to rescue British citizens in an exchange agreement with Germany. If valid identity papers and places could be secured, then documents could be smuggled out to Josek's family. However, procuring such documentation was almost impossible. Such was the demand. Using good connections, Josek secured his golden passes. Valid documentation, together with £50, was given to his contact to smuggle out. 36 British passport holders were expected on the 2nd of December. Time seemed to lengthen. The waiting was interminable. On the scheduled day of arrival, Josek rose early and made his way to Southampton. He stood on the quayside with the rest of the welcoming committee, 20 or so expectant souls whose shattered worlds were about to be repaired. The dock hands steadied the landing jetty and prepared for disembarkation. Then out the passengers filed, clutching children, suitcases, and the rest of their lives. Josek waited. Still they came. There was a mother with two children similar in profile to his own wife and daughters, a family of six, and two elderly women, probably sisters. And then there were no more. Josek froze. He must have missed them somehow. But where were they? He approached a man wielding a clipboard with a passenger manifest. "Yes," he said, "Esther, Miriam and Anya Zucker. They were on board, but everyone has disembarked." "Impossible," replied Josek. "I watched everyone step off and they weren't there." "I'm sorry, sir, but there are no passengers left aboard." Josek spent the next hour walking around the port of Southampton, looking for his wife and children. Not until the evening was the full horror apparent. The woman with the two girls who vaguely resembled his wife and daughters must have travelled using his documents, which were stolen and sold on. Or had they been murdered for them? All Josek knew for certain was that the wrong three individuals stepped ashore. Unwittingly, he had given three strangers the chance of a new life. Worse still, had Josek's actions condemned his loved ones to a death he himself had financed. Josek never heard from his family again. No funerals, no graves, no endpoint to focus his grief. Just a black heart weeping through days so dense that no light could reach him. He did not speak for a year. It was not a self-imposed vow of silence. The words would not form. A few years after the war, he remarried. Blanca was also a survivor, a warm, undemanding woman who did what she could to insulate Josek from his trauma. I have a clear recollection of Blanca from my childhood. My memory of Josek is vaguer. Her openness contrasted with his quasi-catatonia. My mother, Monica, who knew them well, told me that their apartment was bedecked with sketches he had drawn of his daughters, made from those two precious photographs, the only images he possessed of them beyond those he kept in the privacy of his memory. She asked him once if he had ever drawn pictures of anything else. He replied, "What else is there to draw?"
On today's programme, My Hero was by Patricia Joyce Oliver. The Argument for Children was by Rory Gleason. The First Bloomsday, 1904 to 1954, was by Donal Fallon. The Library in the Park by Anne Breslin. And A Cafe Called Doris was by Oliver Sears. The music this morning, Sweets for My Sweet by The Drifters. Beautiful Boy was by John Lennon. Seaside Girls, performed by Doreen Gallagher and Sinead Murphy. And Oft in the Stilly Night was by Thomas Moore, performed by the Moorings, featuring the voice of Simon Morgan. Sunday Miscellany's broadcast coordinator is Elaine Conlon. The producer is Sarah Binchy. Next week, we'll bring you a special live miscellany recorded last weekend at the Belfast Book Festival with Jan Carson, Glenn Patterson, Lucy Caldwell and more. And another live event you might be interested in, Shine, marking the 50th anniversary of the first Dublin Pride March, a collaboration with the RTE Concert Orchestra and Dublin Pride Festival, with guests Wallace Bird, Shobsby and more. It's at the National Concert Hall on Thursday the 20th of June and also University Concert Hall Limerick on Friday the 21st. See rte.ie/co for details.
You've been listening to the Sunday Miscellany podcast. For more from us, you can follow the programme on Facebook, Twitter, Spotify or Apple Podcasts. Just search for RTE Sunday Miscellany.